Exxon's plan for Chad offered to break the pattern of oil-related corruption and violence. It offered a way to use public development funds to stimulate private economic activity in Africa. And it seemed to offer a credible reply to the bank's critics. Persuaded that it had a choice between the bank's terms and no oil revenue, Chad's parliament passed Law 001 in 1998, and Deby signed it the following year. It pledged 10% of the country's future oil revenue to a Future Generations Fund, and 80% of the remainder to priority sectors such as education, health, agriculture, and the environment. In addition to Parliament, a college of civil society groups would provide oversight of these investments. The radicalism of the World Bank's proposed usurpation of Chadian sovereignty attracted diverse allies in Washington and Europe in part because it promised an answer to the resource curse, a syndrome described by economists and political scientists. The curse referred to evidence that when poor countries became suddenly rich in oil or minerals, they can often expect to go backward rather than forward. In 1993, the British economist Richard M. Otey published Sustaining Development in Mineral Economies, the Resource Curse Thesis. His work drew on earlier economic analysis about the Dutch disease, which referred to the distortions that took place within the Netherlands' economy after a major natural gas discovery. Essentially, the resource curse described a condition within governments similar to what happens to many individuals after they win the lottery. When nations become enthralled by the short-term riches offered by a finite national resource, capital and talent often migrated away from more productive and self-sustaining economic sectors such as agriculture, at the expense of long-term national growth and income equality. In 1997, the American political economist Terry Lynn Carl applied these insights to oil development in poorer countries. Her book, The Paradox of Plenty, Oil Booms and Petrostates, used the example of Venezuela to show that weak governments made rich by oil were prone to corruption and underinvestment in agriculture. These countries also sometimes attracted violence among internal factions competing for control of the engorged national bank vault. Philippe Le Billon of the University of British Columbia reviewed 20 separate studies of the resource curse and found that while oil broadly correlates with higher risk of conflict, countries with high wealth per capita faced considerably less danger, even where, as in Saudi Arabia, corruption was pervasive. The highest risk scenario, Le Billon found, was one involving onshore production, institutionally weak central government generating low rents per capita, with high level of dependence on the oil sector. That described Chad. Even before the Doba oil flowed, a southern rebel group, the Armed Forces for a Federal Republic, known by its French acronym as FARF, sprung from nowhere to challenge Idriss Deby's regime for control of the region around the Exxon fields. Deby violently suppressed the FARF and its suspected supporters. The Chadians came in and were quite rough, but they terminated it, recalled an oil industry security advisor who monitored the campaign. Exxon stood by as the oppressive violence occurred. Security was the responsibility of Chad. There were regular exchanges between embassy and Exxon officers when human rights abuses occurred during Deby's counterinsurgency campaign, noted a State Department cable, but these meetings did not consider actions Exxon could possibly undertake in reaction to the abuses. The resource curse thesis spread rapidly among anti-poverty campaigners. By the late 1990s, it had become conventional wisdom among liberal-leaning development economists and policymakers, including some at the World Bank. As a decision about Exxon's oil project neared, anti-poverty groups with long experience in Africa, such as Oxfam and Catholic Relief Services, argued that the World Bank was moving too hastily. Their researchers agreed in principle that Chadians deserved the benefits of their oil wealth, but they doubted that the fragile, violent, embryonic half-democracy over which Idriss Deby presided could offer the political resilience and oversight of oil revenues imagined by the bank. These non-governmental researchers chafed at optimistic assessments published by the bank, which seemed to them to ignore recent events such as Deby's suppression of the FARF. "You really have to examine," What is the nature of the state? Said Ian Gary, who monitored the deal at the time for Catholic Relief Services. You can't just see what you want to see. The Chad Compact also suggested a double standard for Africa. The World Bank and the Clinton administration did not question the right of Saudi Arabia to use its oil revenue to enrich a corrupt royal family. They did not seek to control social spending in the new oil-producing states of Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan, despite the myriad ways those governments failed to serve their people. Why single out Chad? Why single out Africa? The oil project is frankly the only hope on the horizon for the nearly 8 million people of Chad, argued Donald Norland, a former American ambassador to the country who used some of his retirement years to campaign for the oil project. It seems particularly unconscionable, therefore, for outsiders surrounded by modern comforts to oppose the project and thereby condemn the people of Chad to a kind of pristine poverty. It seemed doubtful that Idriss Deby's motivations were as noble. He sent a cousin, Tom Erdemi, to Houston, where Erdemi took an office at Exxon's upstream division and worked as Deby's liaison to the corporation. Erdemi helped to manage and push Deby's negotiations with the bank. The president also appointed Amat Hasabala Subiane as his ambassador to Washington. Subiane was a political activist who believed the oil project would be good for Chad in the long run, but who doubted his own president's sincerity. As the negotiations reached a climax, Deby continued to resist the World Bank's oversight terms. He talked about a plot against the sovereignty of Chad and urged his ambassador to fight. Privately, however, Subiane felt very strongly that the bank and its instruments of control and surveillance would help protect his country against Deby's desire to do whatever he wanted with the oil revenues. Subiane worked to bring Deby around to a compromise.